Hey, folks, today's episode is brought to you by one of my favorite sponsors, SunsetLakeSabadet.com. Use the code LEFTISBEST, all one word, for 20% off your entire order at Sunset Lake. Sunset Lake Sabadet grows, harvests, and ships all of its craft Sabadet products and now herbal tinctures directly from its farm in Northern Vermont, straight to your door. Skip the lines. Find your relief and relaxation at SunsetLakeSabadet.com. You want help with relaxing? Oh, they've got tinctures for that. They've got gummies for that. You want some help sleeping? My God, the tinctures I take from Sunset Lake Sabadet, the gummies I take, they have basically got me off the Ambien, which is amazing. Also, you know, some folks, Matt, I know you're giggling at this, but you can get some flower from them. And if you ever want that feeling like you're smoking something else, but you want to smoke something that's not going to get you quite as loopy, well, they've got flower, they've got keef, they've got pre-rolls, they've got it all. In fact, they've also got salves that will help you with your muscle aches, with lidocaine or with arnica. I got a buddy who is a contractor. I gave him one of the balm sticks, and he is in love, both with me and the salve. They are a great, they use great farming practices, no pesticides. They use integrated pest management. They grow all of their hemp outdoors in the Vermont sun, and they have sustainable farming practices that they developed with the University of Vermont. And they're also movement partners. They have given thousands of dollars. In fact, over $100,000 over the past, I don't know, 5 or 6 years to criminal justice reform like the Innocence Project and the Last Prisoner Project. They've given money and done mutual aid with the Vermont Food Bank and Feeding Champlain Valley. They have given money to Workers' Strikes Relief Fund. They've given money to Planned Parenthood, Give Directly. They've given money to the Afghanistan Refugee Resettlement Fund. They've given money to UNRWA. They give a lot of local support in Vermont as well to Vermont Public Radio, the Community Foundation, the Green Mountain Club, et cetera, et cetera. It's just a great company and a great product. And you can get 20% off with the coupon code LEFTISBEST. Do it now. I mean, right after we start the show.
That means Monday is Casual Monday, Tuesday, Casual Tuesday, Wednesday, Casual Hump Day, Thursday, Casual Thurs, that's what we call it, and Friday, Casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Friday, September 4th. 2026. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Ested Herndon, editorial director at Vox, host of America Actually, and publisher of the Midterms Actually newsletter on Substack. Also on the program today, better than expected jobs report, 162,000 jobs added, 98% of which went to women. Meanwhile, however, wage growth slows and is losing to inflation. And these new job numbers show that native-born Americans still at basically the same employment rates, suggesting that maybe these mass deportations have nothing to do with jobs other than hurting them. U.S. diesel prices are at an all-time high. Vance says Iran controls whether the non-war we're engaged in will continue. as Howard Nutlick admits that he didn't know the U.S. has suffered any casualties in this non-war. House passes legislation that blocks federal aid for universities that don't support Israel. Republican House leaders shorten the House session. It will go on a 7-week vacation after September 17th, putting me to shame. White House appeals to the Supreme Court to allow mail voting to be curtailed by the post office. The Missouri Supreme Court voids new maps, new congressional maps for the midterms, despite the fact they had already been used for the primaries. Trump regime closes 23 U.S. Forest Research and Development stations en route to contracting more than 15% of its workforce. And Israel's national security minister announces a plan for the illegal forced expulsion of all Palestinians from Gaza. Bernie Sanders intros legislation to ban AI superintelligence and to pause AI development. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. It is Friday.
Yes, it is.
Casual Friday.
Casual
indeed.
Friday.
Yes. People are asking if I said Nutlick on purpose, and I'm sorry. I did.
Yes. It's too easy.
It's easy. Mean, but why not?
He deserves a little disrespect after just blanking on the fact that we've lost over a dozen U.S. service members in this war that his administration has started. I think he'll survive Nutlick.
He definitely values their sacrifice.
Oh, totally.
Totally values their sacrifice. We got a lot to get to today on the program, and I am determined to take phone calls in the fun half today. Just a reminder, you can join us in the fun half by becoming a member of the Majority Report at jointhemajorityreport.com. And while I'm here, I might as well also say, don't forget justcoffee.coop. Fair trade coffee, hot chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. Get 10% off. All fair trade. Great co-op out in Madison, Wisconsin. You can buy the Majority Report blend. Like I say, you can buy a bunch of other blends or single origin coffees. They take real good care of their suppliers down in Chiapas and in East Africa. Really worth the visit over to justcoffee.coop. I'm embarrassed because for months we have been calling this a war on Iran because, of course, we have been bombing them. We have killed who knows how many thousands of civilians, at least multiple thousands of civilians, maybe more with some of the fallout that will follow this. I guess we're not calling it a war anymore.
Well, we never did, right? Even though Trump was comparing it to Vietnam, to Iraq, to World War II, to casualty figures, he would go speak about those wars and say, and this excursion is a little bit different because legally they're kind of in a gray area as it results.
They don't want me to call it a war.
By prosecuting this war because Congress is supposed to have the authority to do so.
Of course, Mike Johnson complains when people say, why aren't you doing anything in relation to this war? As far as he's concerned, he has no power to do anything. He's the number three most powerful person in the country. At least in terms of succession. Here is Caitlin Collins at a White House press. Now, understand that J.D. Vance's, I guess, allies, to the extent that he has anybody who likes him in the administration, are gone in some respects. The Secretary of the Army was recently essentially jettisoned, in part because he went in to talk to Trump about the war.
Apparently, this might just be a rumor. This might just be a rumor.
This is a little fake news.
Yeah, this might be. I clarified this before the show, but I'm not sure you heard it. It wasn't. Apparently, he went to talk to Trump about the war and didn't get the response he wanted. There are some naughty people speculating on Twitter that he mentioned the ballroom.
It's almost impossible to imagine he didn't mention the ballroom,
exactly.
Frankly. But nevertheless, he is gone. And J.D. Vance is out there flacking for this non-war. One of the – I just saw a tweet. One of the I think the founders or one of the publishers of the American Conservative has basically said, I can't vote for this administration because of their involvement in this non-war. Here is excursion. Here is Caitlin Collins asking J.D. Vance about the story of an airman's wife, now widow, who is unable to get benefits because her husband died in apparently what is a non-war.
Caitlin. Mr. Vice President, thank you. I've got two questions for you. First, the widow of an airman who was killed in the Iran war says she's having trouble getting some of the benefits that they should have access to because it has not been officially declared a war. Can you and the president personally ensure that the family of Alex Klinner gets all the benefits that they deserve, given he died serving the country?
Okay, so what's her name? You said his name is Alex Klinner?
Yeah, he was an airman who was killed in the plane that went down over Western Iraq.
So what I'd say, Caitlin, is please, if you have the private contact information, we will reach out to her directly as soon as this is over and make sure that she gets what she's entitled to. Obviously, our heart breaks for every single person who lost their lives in this operation. And, as much as our heart breaks, I can't possibly fathom a young widow, what she's feeling and dealing with it. And so we want to be as helpful as we can and ensure she gets everything that she's entitled to. So we will certainly work that on the back end as soon as that. And my message to her would be, we love you. We're grateful for the sacrifice. And we very much take very seriously our commitment to get you what you need to get.
Got three young children.
We love you. That's basically what he said. Love you.
Yeah. this operation. Can you imagine a patient on a operating table for 5-6 months with the doctors saying, "Yeah, we don't know how this ends. We have no way of ending it, really."
But we love you.
But we love you.
But we love you very much.
But it's an operation, not a war.
Love ya. And also, hey, reporter, can you give me the contact information of the widow? That was maybe the most egregious part to me. There have been 18 service members that we know of that died. You can't, run it through your Grok AI and figure out who she's speaking about here, you psycho. Why do you need to get the phone number from the CNN reporter? You're the government.
Seems kind of threatening, too.
It does. It does. Asking about the name as well in that public way, it feels like an intimidation tactic because they're not clearly giving her benefits that she deserves proactively.
We should also say this comes on the in the wake of another, in this instance, bombing of a wedding where at least 4 people were dead, scores injured by the U.S. in this operation, as he calls it. In fact, here's Caitlin Collins again asking if this war will be over by the midterms.
In terms of the war and the timeline, given this administration has put timelines out there before, what you just said about no negotiations happening with Iran, will this war be over by the time of the midterm elections?
Well, Caitlin, again, I wouldn't call it a war. Right now, there is no active shooting. I recognize there have been places where this has flared up. Major combat operations, again, major combat operations lasted for about 6 weeks. And
not a war.
Not a war, just major combat operations. When is he saying that it was a war and now it's not a war or what?
I'm not sure what they think this is going to solve. Additionally, it's not like Congress is going to pursue any action for you starting an illegal war. We saw that already. If you tell the American public that there's no war going on, they're still facing $4.15 an average of a gallon at the pump. And diesel right now is out of control, hitting a near record high, which is going to impact and already is impacting food prices. Something like 15 to 30% of food prices are the result of the energy costs, and diesel is used for shipping goods. So grocery prices are already out of control, and it takes a little bit of a while for these shocks to be felt, but it's happening at the absolute worst time, I think, for the Republicans. It's getting worse and worse.
In February, J.D. Vance gave an interview to the Washington Post and said, the idea that we're going to be in the Middle Eastern in a Middle Eastern war for years with no end in sight, there is no chance that will happen.
Well, I mean, to be fair, he didn't say there's no chance that we won't be involved in a Middle East operation. With absolutely no possible sight and end. So let's be fair about this.
They also want the opportunity, if they so choose, to be able to restart this war after the midterms if they want. They're worried about the political fallout. But let's be clear, there are mass Islamophobes, neocons, and Zionists in this administration that are deeply unhappy with the results of the war, that will try to double back once they feel like the political headwinds are a little bit less difficult for the Republicans. Certainly Benjamin Netanyahu will, after his election is over. I just want to also point out that this is the exact fantasy that liberal Zionists, when we're talking about Israel, and there's a report in the Jerusalem Post that they are floating to Trump that he should offer student debt relief for anybody that signs up for the Iran war. I'm not sure how true that is.
AJ Jaffe in the Jerusalem Post wrote an op-ed where one of the things he said is not only student loan debt, but also credit card debt should be dischargeable if you serve, because there's only currently about 400 or so thousand troops in America. And if you're going to invade Iran like they want, you need about 1.5 million.
My point is just that
we're going to fill the ranks with the indebted people.
Yeah, Klarna's going to fill the ranks. The Klarna Brigades.
Israel had, right. Yeah, going to war for my third Klarna payment on my dig in lunch order. But like, but Israel also has elections in October. And this is the exact scenario that liberal Zionists said was going to put pressure on the Israeli government to be more moderate. And the exact opposite is happening. Like, oh, if once Benjamin Netanyahu and his coalition is held to account by the democracy within Israel, they're going to back off of this whole genocide, ethnic cleansing, and pushing the U.S. into the war in Iran thing. No, it turns out that actually the political constituency that Benjamin Netanyahu has to appeal to get reelected is like the settler community. And they're sprinting further and further right and giving the settlers whatever they wanted. And that same group of people is also trying to get the U.S. continuously embroiled in this war.
We will talk a little more about that, I imagine, with Stead Herndon, who will be joining us in a moment. Editorial director at Vox, host of America, actually, publisher of the Midterms, actually, newsletter on Substack. First, a word from our sponsor today. Have you ever thought I should really be doing something to protect myself from stalkers or scammers or hackers, but you're not sure what? Well, here's what I did well before they became sponsors. I would say over a decade ago. And that is go to www.joindeleteme.com/majority. Although, to be fair, over a decade ago, they weren't sponsoring the program. So there was no slash majority on that. But for you, you can go to joindeleteme.com/majority, enter the code majority, and you will get 20% off. Delete Me, what it does is they remove your personal information as being sold online from media brokers. For about $5, anybody can go to any number of sites on the internet to find all sorts of personal information about you, your phone number in instances, your emails, your addresses, your relatives, your past addresses. It goes on and on. And what happens, at least in the context of like phishing scams and stolen identity, is that hackers will take information that they have bought on the dark web, pair it up with these other things, either use it to phish you and trick you to giving more information, or to create an entire fake identity for you. The number of scams in this country that Americans have been subjected to in 2025 was up something like 25% from the year before. And I suspect it's because we don't longer have government agencies that are working on this type of thing. But particularly in the age of AI, we're all vulnerable to scammers using that personal data. You can get an individual plan for as little as over $8 per month. Discounts get even better with a two-year plan or when you enroll with your partner or family. DeleteMe does all the hard work to wipe your personal information off of these data broker websites, and they do it continually. They send you a digest every month, tell you what they found, where they found it, and what they got rid of, because these brokerage sites repopulate themselves. I want to thank DeleteMe for sponsoring the Majority Report. Be sure to go to joindeleteme.com/majority so you get to the site. We're recommending take control of your data. Keep your private life private by signing up for DeleteMe now at a special discount for our audience. You get 20% off your DeleteMe plan when you go to www.joindeleteme.com/majority. Use the promo code majority at checkout. The only way you're going to get 20% off, go to joindeleteme.com/majority. Enter the code majority at checkout. That's joindeleteme.com/majority. Use the code majority. We'll, of course, put that info in the podcast and YouTube descriptions. Now, a quick break. And when we come back, it's Ed Herndon, editorial director at Vox. We'll be right back. We are back. Emma Viglin, Sam Seder on the Majority Report. Real pleasure to welcome back to the program, Ed Herndon, editorial director at Vox, host of America, actually, and publisher of the Midterms, actually, newsletter on Substack, a very smart extension of the brand.
Yeah, got it right. Got to find new audiences. We wanted to make sure we could name what we were doing in the pod in the written form.
Fantastic. You had a piece, it's been like a relatively slow news week relative to this era. Yeah. The destruction of our government continues unabated. The what is apparently a non-war now also continues. But you wrote a piece about something has dominated the news, and I have to say, like, I really found your piece on this to be really instructive and insightful. You talk about Hassan Piker and this obviously concerted effort to make him radioactive. Tell us your theory of the case.
Yeah, I mean, it somewhat has been from seeing it develop, I feel like, somewhat from a front row view. I mean, after the 2024 election, a lot of folks, and even in my kind of mainstream media world, were going to Piker as a voice for why Dems lost, as a helpful explanation of how Dems lost the internet. And I think specifically someone with credibility around calling the party to task about things like abandoning Palestinians and I think abandoning a platform on immigration. I remember doing his stream about some of that stuff leading into 2024. What changed, and I think what I tried to track in that piece was, frankly, you know, some folks got rubbed the wrong way, not necessarily by the, I think by more than kind of what they're giving on. But we interviewed Third Way about their Hassan Piker op-ed in the Wall Street Journal. They said what really kicked it off was that he was at CrookedCon, and they didn't like the fact that he was on stage with some mainstream media-y type figures. And this all happens before he starts campaigning with progressive candidates. I remember in that interview with Third Way, they guaranteed El-Sayed would not win the primary. And then they said, oh, well, if you're in primary, he'll lose the general or he'll run away from Hassan. That's the only way he'll win in that race. And so it became pretty clear that the effort wasn't necessarily what was being led on. I was asking them, okay, well, would you be mad at a demographer going on Piker's stream? They're like, oh, no, not if you kind of call out the things we don't like. I'm like, okay, can they go on Rogan? Can they go on other places? They're like, oh, we want Democrats to take their message everywhere. And yet there's been so much time spent, I think, making a concerted effort to make him and that stream radioactive. And so I was pointing out the reasons why that's a political advantage to centrists, you know, because that is an independent way for progressives to raise money right now, because that is a place where they can go around mainstream media. And I see the frustration kind of in mainstream media universe with a fractured ecosystem that has produced the likes of Hassan Piker, that has stepped into a credibility void that we've left open. And so all of that felt like it was swirling around but unsaid. And so in that piece, I was trying to put some of that out there, because when we interviewed these folks, they were pretty open about it. It wasn't a secret where some of this was coming from. It was, I think, an attempt to marginalize not just this individual person, but a growing wing in the party that has more power.
But why him then is the question, right? I mean, typically you would see this effort to define a politician in a particularly negative way. But
yeah,
it appears to me that Third Way, at the very least, has the wherewithal to understand that AOC, Bernie Sanders, Zohran Mamdani are some of the most popular Democrats among the base in the country. So is it your assessment that they view now, with DSA being a fairly leaderless movement that's a little bit more dispersed and also can be local with the chapter that you're involved in, that they see Hassan as the figurehead that they're trying to define, even as the public is saying, what you think is important is not what we think is important?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're explaining it exactly right. I mean, this is a sort of leaderless movement. This is a grassroots thing that's happening. And so in a kind of the primary season, it was helpful to have a face to put to that, to demonize. And I think we should say, like, you know, Zohran Mamdani, AOC, Bernie Sanders, they haven't said some of the things Hassan has said. He is more incendiary than some of those figures. And so it's a helpful latch for them. But I also think we should say that some of this is a misunderstanding or a later understanding of a media ecosystem that's changed over a long period of time. I mean, some of these folks, I think, have been late to figure out the kind of streaming universe and kind of how it operates. And so one of the things that, like, I had to explain to somebody, I'm like, you know, in that world, you know, the level of I think, kind of open conspiracy, the level of open bigotry, the level of open kind of misinformation is such that sometimes the stuff that, you know, folks are tagging on Hassan, I think, are kind of low level. I mean, like, when you are a young person on the internet, you have read people make 9/11 jokes for a long time at this point. Like, I see in soccer watching overtly racist, overtly bigoted, overtly sexist things all the time. And so that's not even to say that that's a defense of what some of the stuff the man has said, but that is to say that I think a generation of people have grown up swimming in some of that, and an internet that swims in some of that. And so you're having an establishment use someone as a proxy that I feel like if you live in that world, you're like, I kind of heard that last week, you know, like, so I'm saying that I think some of that is just a general misunderstanding and a helpful tool, I think, for an establishment seeking to marginalize an upcoming generation.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, like, I find most of it being disingenuous. Frankly, you know, I think I rewatched that Jonathan Carl interviewing AOC. You know, he said that America deserved 9/11, which I think is a ham-fisted way of saying blowback, which, you know, 20 years ago, 22 years ago, I was interviewing Chalmers Johnson, a very prominent academic who had written an entire book about blowback and the implications of our involvement. And that stuff is, it's not particularly profound whatsoever, and it's certainly terrain that has been covered. So I think there's a lot of disingenuousness involved in it. And I think what I found really insightful about your piece was this is as much about 2028 as anything else.
Yeah.
I think that like there is a twofer for them, for the centrist, if they can show that Abdul El-Sayed is not going to win or can get him in some ways to act as a drag on his chances in Michigan. I think that has been to so far a failure. His polling numbers have actually slowly increased, if anything, since this has started in Michigan. But that the bigger issue is they don't want the array of candidates that are out there to get benefit from choosing a lane where they would gain the younger people and as manifested in Hassan Piker's support. They want to keep people from being able to raise money early on in particular, I think. This is really about, it seems to me, the first 6 months of the 2028 primary more than anything else.
Because that's the gatekeeping period. That's the period where it's usually only a certain amount of people tuned in, where that's where money's raised. That's where a lot of candidates kind of live and die before the public tunes into the race. And so I tell people, like, the time in which the kind of elite consensus has the most impact is in that window. Yeah. And so I think we should see this as a midterms effort that that marginalizes an important avenue ahead of a time in which that could be critical for candidates to last or raise money or generate early interest, right? I remember even in Zohra Mamdani's mayoral election, his stream with Hassan was a early kind of marker from him getting national attention. That was before even some of those bigger viral videos. And so I think you're right to call out the nature of that. And that's what I was trying to do in the piece, to say, like, you know, these litmus tests are not just about the primary. But the flip side is true, too. Like, you know, we can frame it on the kind of centrist, I would say, bad faith effort. But the opposite is also true, that progressives have an opportunity to prove a different electability model in this midterms. If El-Sayed is to win, or if an Angie Nixon can pull off a crazy upset or come closer than whatever, I think it helps really show that some of the electability tags that people are putting on these candidates, you can shake free of. And so it is certainly, I think, the strategy to make him radioactive and to cut off, I think, a lane that and to tag them with that unelectable label that we know is the same that Bernie faced and the same that other progressives have faced previously. But I would also say there is an opportunity here to show that the electorate is listening to that less and less. The primary was one piece of that. But if El-Sayed were to win, I would say Nixon's another one of those, Troy Jackson, like some of these candidates running in these battleground districts are not doing so, what I would say, from a third way paradigm. And so in the same way that they're trying to tag El-Sayed to as a proof point of unelectability, it could boomerang in the opposite way.
Well, if we're talking about the general election, I think the better example then is Donald Trump, where the Democratic establishment 100%. Was, what'd you say?
100%.
Right? Like they thought that they could define Donald Trump in this negative way. They deployed the Pied Piper strategy, and it turns out once again, and this was 10 years ago at this point, D.C. was out of step with what a lot of people thought. And they did not have the credibility to make these arguments against Trump, and now we're seeing the devastating consequences of that. You mentioned Angie Nixon. I know you spoke to her this week, and we also did on Monday. She was accused by Gayle King of campaigning with Hassan Piker. She got the notes from on high, maybe from Barry Weiss or anybody associated, and she was completely wrong. And then still had this aggressive posture towards Angie Nixon as if she did campaign with Hassan. And it goes to show. And then there was this other, Casey Hunt had this really rude, disrespectful, frankly, interview of her on CNN as well, where they have this aggression towards her and this fury towards her. And they're even using lies to tag her, to tie her to Hassan when that wasn't the case. And it goes to show that it's not about Hassan. It's about them losing control of the electorate and people seeing that, like, these ideas are what is resonating with them. And I guess I'm curious about your thoughts on that as well. The reaction to Angie Nixon.
And I tweeted this, but like the institutional media right now, I think is in a real tough spot, and it bums me out. In a tough spot of some of our own creation, but I just think like the credibility gap and like sometimes the posture we're taking with some of these candidates that are coming from nowhere, not come from traditional vetting or are unknown to electorate, is just unnecessarily hostile.
Working class, too. They're also classist.
That's particularly true for people who don't come through the DC lens of the right person. That often overlaps with class boundaries, racial boundaries, gender. But I think specifically, and Angie Nixon spoke to this in both of our interviews, she understands that, you know, a progressive Black woman is going to be tagged with a kind of specific label. And she's just overtly rejecting it. She's just saying, like, I don't care. If you put me in this, I don't care. If Republicans run all these ads about socialism, like, I am going to build as many alliances as possible and live and die on that kind of vision. And I think that kind of clarity is you know, in the kind of traditional establishment view of electability, they never factor in how that sort of clarity crosses ideological bounds. Like, people appreciate authentic, clear communicators, and they will take people who disagree with them or they disagree with on a specific issue if they find them to be morally consistent. And so, really, I don't know why we have to learn this lesson over and over, because Donald Trump is an example of this, some of this stuff, too. And like, I have heard Republicans over a course of the last 10 years learn to shed the establishment's view of electability. They've shed it. They don't believe the prism of who can win and not. They are more concerned with putting their party in an ideological and value direction that they care about more. That's what's happening with Democrats.
I feel like even Bill Clinton at one point said strong and wrong beats right and weak. But getting back, I mean, I'm really curious as to your thoughts about how effective this is going to be, because in the general, I mean, absent all of this very concerted effort to make Piker radioactive, I would have predicted that most of these candidates who are in a purple state, would have distanced themselves from Piker, if not like explicitly, just implicitly in the general. I mean, that's just basically what you do, particularly when you're in a purple state, not necessarily changing their positions, but not highlighting that. I think this effort by Third Way, and also aided by the mainstream media, and I want to talk about that narrow perspective on it in a minute, but that they have been able to force a lot of these politicians to maintain some distance. Like, you know, Syed, I don't know if he was ever planning to have Piker come into Michigan, but he's not going to do that now.
For Nixon's a good example. I mean, having to proactively disavow Piker.
Yes.
Before they've even, you know, like,
before they've ever had a relationship with him. But I wonder, and the idea is, again, is that sort of like the pre-primary era when people are trying to raise money, where they're trying to get into the bloodstream of the primary and to stake out lanes in which they're going to go. Because I think there's some, you know, who, I don't think Andy Beshear is going to come out and become this, you know, sort of like progressive champion, but that's the type of thing that I think would worry a Third Way consultant, is that somebody who codes red state or purple state decides, I'm going to take this lane, that, you know, could have been in like, you know, the in, you know, in 2020 or 2016, you know, someone who sort of tries to move just slightly to the right of like a Bernie Sanders and fill that void. I don't know who that would be, but they want to keep Piker away from him. And I just wonder if that's going to actually work in the context of a primary. I mean, we saw Mallory McMurrow try it in her primary, and yep. it failed miserably. Piker has a different sort of like aura now, but I wonder if, you know, things are not going to get better for Third Way for these centrists and frankly for like the Zionist contingency, because I think there's a lot of people who see this
as overlapping.
Yeah, yes.
Yeah. I'll do a roundabout way of getting at this. I mean, remember when there was 20 Democrats running in 2020 or whatever, like I remember talking to Third Way at that time. They did not prefer Joe Biden. They were trying to make some of these other candidates, they were swimming in the kind of Harris, Buttigieg, Klobuchar-y lane. And let's remember, like, the ones who tried to execute in all of the above strategy in that primary failed. Like, the folks who lasted was Bernie Sanders on one yep. side, Joe Biden on another side, and even the folks who lasted towards the end, I think, chose more explicit parts of that lane. So it is difficult, I think, more difficult than they acknowledge, to run a Mallory McMorrow-esque please everybody or style thing across Democrats. Like, you kind of have to stake stuff at some point. And so whether it's Piker or something else, I don't think you make it through that Democratic primary weather vaning to the latest Twitter controversy.
The like, progressive who means well, but just can't get it over the finish
so, like,
line.
Honestly, to me, like, and this is, I'm like, when I saw Ossoff release that statement about Piker, less than actually about responding to what I think was a thing taken out of context and all of that stuff. Like, we can go through the facts of it, but more so, I thought, I don't know if I would get in the habit of responding to like the 30-hour X news cycle. Like, I think that's a losing game.
Agree totally.
I thought, why? Interesting.
More than any other thing, that in particular, when Ossoff did that, because Piker has not been anywhere near Georgia.
Yeah, they've not campaigned together.
And Ossoff has been like studious in trying to avoid issues, like even around like crypto and AI. He doesn't have a great record there. I mean, he has really tried to stay in this like anti-corruption lane, which is a very sort of comfortable place.
Yeah.
You know, J.D. Vance is in that lane too, yeah. right? Like, but it just so happens he happens to be in the administration that's committing a lot of that corruption. But yeah, I found that really interesting. And I really wonder what that says about his donor, because that was something that I can't imagine. It feels like somebody went specifically to Ossoff's campaign and said, do this. And he put it through a statement. He didn't say it. It didn't come out of his mouth.
And we know how this stuff works, like particularly in a primary. I mean, I remember as a reporter on that 20 Democratic landscape, you could ask about anything to get a statement about anything. You could pitch somebody against somebody, and then all of a sudden it's an issue, and then they never actually said it at a campaign event. So I think we should ask about kind of a media role in here too. But I'm just saying, from a candidate perspective, I feel like holding that clarity about what matters most to voters will be what separates this mass group who runs next year. And so one thing that Joe Biden understood throughout that whole primary was people were scared about Donald Trump. Like, yeah. That was the smartest thing that they never budged on, was we do not care if we get bullied on Twitter every single day, because this is going to be about Donald Trump. That was correct, right? Like, and so all I'm saying is, if you're going to operate in a lane of people if you're going to operate like kind of outside of the progressive sphere, and I remember making this point for you all before, like, I do not think you can follow the moderate elite version of politics, the Third Way version of politics, to success. That has to be something that also speaks what moderate working class voters are thinking about. And I think that is the ruse that Third Way is putting up. is saying that their litmus tests are shared by the larger base of centrists in the Democratic Party. And I do not think that's true.
Yeah, they're not playing to the electorate in this instance. Yeah. They are going directly to intimidate candidates, period.
Media, like it is an elite-to-elite conversation.
100%. Go ahead, Emma, sorry.
No, it's just when you mentioned 2020, it's just so notable to me how much the conversation has shifted on the notion of electability as well. Like, Biden was able to pitch, I'm the only one that can defeat Donald Trump, but we're seeing this also with the impeachment adjacent Democrats just getting swamped in this primary cycle, mm-hmm. whether it's Diana DeGette, whether it's Dan Goldman, whether it's Vindman down with Angie Nixon, yep. No one cared. People are like, wait, you guys failed to keep him out of power. Why would we trust you to do it again? And I think that the establishment has not caught up to the fact that like, even if voters just care about hating Donald Trump, which is an older part of the Democratic Party electorate, they have lost credibility with that core group as well.
Right. That's big difference from Trump 1 to Trump 2, is that it can no longer be centralized around what was the Joe Biden premise of Donald Trump as an anomaly in American politics, the Trump movement as a singular moment that could be stamped out. Nobody, obviously, that's not true anymore. It is the fundamental movement that has reshaped our government and is doing so. And so, like, I think folks understand that. And so even, even the step away from impeachment as a motivating factor, I think speaks to Democrats thinking more structurally, right? Like thinking more big ideas and finishing an idea's primary that collapsed in 2020. Like it is not that they finished their conversation on what they believe on immigration or what they believe on healthcare or whatever. It is that COVID hit, all this other stuff happened, and Joe Biden actually, and one, forget thinking about that, you know, like, and think about Donald Trump. And so I'm like, that's the evolution of the base will be expressed in this next presidential primary, but also the kind of unfinished work, is, I think, important to recognize too, because it's not as if, like, I think Democrats are coming out of a clear vision of who they are, more so than we're starting on the ground floor. And I think that perspective is helpful.
Yeah, I'm happy to hear that, Jeffries is talking about if the Democrats take control of the House and, who knows, the Senate, there's going to be an attempt to, reinvigorate Medicaid and to help in the ACA and all of those things. But none of all of that is returned to where we were 2 years ago. There's no sort of like even nascent vision of what our policies are going to be on immigration, what our policies are going to be on healthcare. There's none of that. There seems to be very, very, I imagine behind some closed doors, various factions have their ideas, but there seems to be no sort of like cohesive ideas of what the Democratic Party wants to do in a post-Trump era in the event that they win in 2028. I want to also just turn to the media, because it's also fascinating how the media jumped on this this scrum on Piker. Because, like, Dana Bash was like openly criticizing Piker for things that she had said in the past, practically. Not to pick on Dana Bash, although I'm happy to pick on Dana Bash. But like that was indicative, I think, of what was going on. To me, that just reads like, it's summer. We don't have to do any work. This is like basically if we were hosting a TMZ show, although TMZ is actually doing some fairly good work these days. But like, honestly, it's like, this is, this is where we all get to play Andy Cohen and talk about Real Housewives. We don't have to do any reading in this.
I can't believe you know who that is. I cannot believe you know who that is or his most favorite housewife.
His homework too, you know.
You know who it is?
I
gave Andy Cohen his first TV appearance ever, but that's
Point. Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie were married, but you know Andy Cohen knows what Real Housewives about Real Housewives? Oh, anyway, yeah.
But the point being, that it makes it easier. It's just easier to cover. Like you don't have to do the work.
No, I think you're right that the media failure has been central to a lot of this. And I think that there's been a lack of curiosity just about like an earnest reflection on the changing of the base. Like some of this, I think, reads as uncomfort with where the base is and sort of advocacy to reimpose what they think the guardrails of political discourse should be rather than actually follow where people are going. But I mean, as someone who has spent an unfortunate amount of time in Washington, D.C., I cannot overstate their distance from baselines of both parties, to be honest with you. And so they're working from an abstract. It actually really upsets me. I saw somebody say, like, you know, the Democratic Party is not all Bushwick and Brooklyn. I'm like, North Brooklyn would be a much better representation 100%. Of like a group of working class people than both of you people interact with. Like, you wish you were in Bushwick, right? Like, and so, like, I just wish like there was a better acknowledgement of like how many of these people are just treated as poll numbers, are treated as like abstractions. And so I'm saying that really matters because, like, in things like the shifting sentiment around Israel, I think it is very convenient to localize that to like a group of highly online campus protest style Hassan Piker watchers, even like that is it is a bigger group than that. Like the real importance of the shift is that it is not just localized to that or something like AI pushback happening right now or like block camera pushback. Like, or Epstein a year ago. Oh, no, you keep going down the line, like, on these things. And I'm like, it is a very convenient view to say that that is just the position of the people who most annoy them on X. And that is not true.
I think, as an example, the Flock stuff, like, I keep hearing of Flock cameras getting removed from rural towns.
Yeah. Well, this is Iowa. We had this poll in our packet from Emerson that voters opposed their community using flock cameras, installed automated cameras, 61% to 26%. Very similar numbers on data centers. 60% thinks that it'll impact the environment negatively. 52% think that it'll impact the cost of living negatively. And then 62% of Iowa voters in general oppose data centers being built near their community. So just to add to what you're saying, this is Iowa. These are also farmers impacted, too, by the rising fertilizer prices, gas prices, Trump's tariff war. This is a very, very dramatic shift, I think, right now. And these are like populist ideas that are being handed to certain Democrats. And you have certain Democrats that are afraid to touch it.
I mean, absolutely. So I'm saying like, that's on the ground. Like now JD Vance might pick it up. Like, you know, like somebody's going to pick it up though. Like, and there is a legitimate shift that you see Greg Abbott waffling on flock cameras. Like that is being reflected cross party. And so that's all I'm saying is like, you know, there was a version of the way I think Democrats egregiously ignored base in the lead up to 2024. And I'm not even dealing with any of that. We're in new versions now. Like, I'm only talking about the last couple of years. And on the last couple of years, if you're not talking about people's anxiety around the future of work, if you're not recognizing people's mass, the distrust Donald Trump, like, stole even, like, from reversing on affordability or reversing on what people thought would be no new roars, like, if you're not flowing from those type of places, you're not hearing, I think, what have been undeniable sorts of shifts. And so, like, when we were at the data center town hall 6 months ago, it was, you know, you heard about environmental concerns, people had brought their electricity bills, but it was really about a process that had shut them out, that folks were universally upset that they felt like they had been, frankly, given up to these tech overlords without a federal or local government advocating for them. And in that room is such an understanding of, like, there's like an assumed nature of the way Congress won't come to help them, and the federal government will not be there to help them. And I'm like, that's a reflection of reality, right? Like that, like, I'm saying that's a wrong takeaway, but they just made it, just for someone who lives in national politics, it was just like, there is such an opportunity here to be someone who does put people, workers' interest in mind in a time when anxiety is so high. But like, yes, that will require you being on the opposite side of some money interest. And so whether they pick that up or not, who knows?
How do you distinguish between local and national, though, in the age of social media as well? And if
that's a great question.
Like I understand that the data center stuff and the Flock Hammer stuff is specifically local, but it's a national story in that the activism around it is fairly universal across massive parts of the country, or different swaths of the country.
Yeah, I think that's a great question. I think it's harder and harder to untangle those things. Like, you used to come, I mean, I've been going to congressional or midterms races 10 years now, and used to feel like you were kind of out of a bubble or in a non-nationalized space, then that's really different now. You hear people talk about kind of more top-down issues, and I think even that type of activism that spreads on social and stuff, like, it's hard to determine local, national, offline, online, those lines are blurring. So I think that's important to point out. I guess I just to say it from, like, who their blame was pointed at, right? Like, their blame was really a mayor and city council that they felt had a duty to inform. And then when you think federally, their anger was the absence of proactive protection, right? Like, and so I'm saying the kind of how they expressed who they were, why they were blaming one side and the other was different. But I do think you're right that the kind of broken government fundamental feeling crosses state and local. I mean, national and local.
My sense is that, like, data centers has become an avatar for a whole mass of frustration around this stuff. And it's just, this is the most sort of like material and concrete thing that we can show our anger towards, because everything else is sort of ephemeral. Like, you know, we just don't, this is something that we can see it. It's going to be built here. And it's in our community, and this we can fight against. It's almost like this is the one thing where we can make our stand, because everything else is just sort of like in the air, and we can't quite find something to fight against it. Let's turn for a moment, though. We just have a couple more minutes, but the efforts by the Republicans. I mean, right now the polling is such that I think in a vacuum, it is quite clear the Democrats are going to take the House. I mean, it's been, I think, quite clear for months. But, you know, some are looking at like tsunami levels, particularly with some of the gerrymandering, which brought, you know, Republican plus 15 House districts down to like Republican plus 8 or something.
Yep.
But there is a very concerted effort to screw up the voting. Texas just shut in one of their biggest counties. I think they went down to they changed the ratio. Typically, I think it's like 1,100 people per voting place around the country. And in one of their biggest counties, they made it over 5,000 people per.
I think that includes Fort Worth, which is one of the highest concentration of Black voters as well, that particular county, of course.
Yeah. And we're seeing this, you know, various localized versions of this. And now we're seeing the sort of the mail-in ballot thing. We got to rely on the Supreme Court to sort of say, you know, I don't know what's going to happen with that case. A judge in Boston basically said, like, you don't even have anything ready for me to make an assessment of, which is why the Supreme Court sent it back to her in the first place. And it's still not ready. But the Supreme Court, I don't know if they're going to do it again or what. But what's your sense of, like, of the efforts to push back on this? And have you seen anything on the ground in terms of, like, the get out the vote effort by the Democrats to deal with this?
I mean, I would say, one, like, it's right to point out, because this is the Republican strategy, is that we can kind of guess where the next several months are going to go. They have a lot of money, like, so they will flood airwaves. There will likely be a manufacturer crisis, you know. I expect a caravan or some form of, like, imminent fear. And also, really importantly, it's the rules of the game. Like, they initially were kind of doing that gerrymandering effort. You're right to point out some of that has not turned out as they wanted. But, you know, Trump has pushed ahead, not only, like, furthering these claims, but, you know, they have a task force looking at things, mail-in ballots. When we just did a call out for our listeners about things that they most had questions about for midterms, it was all about election security, election integrity. I saw that Eric Holder and Democrats have had a national task force they're doing on it. We interviewed kind of midtermy governors who all kind of talked about having, like, proactive plans, but they didn't want to chase Donald Trump declares a national emergency. But I think people are in a kind of waiting pattern to see how far he plans to take this. And so the unfortunate fact is, like, we don't know. We don't know whether the Supreme Court is you know, what they're going to do with mail-in ballots. We don't know how much pressure Donald Trump is going to exert on about voting rolls, which he's already tried to do in some states to push back. But I think the big question to me is about his constant teasing of a national emergency. Is that something he follows through on? You know, when we talked to one of Trump's advisors earlier this year, he said his biggest regret was that he didn't declare a national emergency for Minnesota and ICE, because he thought that would have had them in there quicker and faster. And so they're pushing him to do that for November. And so I think all of those stuff are real concerns. My unfortunate answer is, like, so much of this is about his willingness to blow through the lines.
Right.
And I do think Democrats have been planning, or at least have said that they are aware of the possibility of those things. But they're going to be reactive to see what he does.
Lastly, the one little sort of very inside story this week was the defection of two Democrats to vote with Republicans, not just on a piece of legislation, but something that never happens, which allows for a rules change, which allowed essentially some fast tracking of these bills and to face less hurdles on getting to the floor. And this rules change is sort of unprecedented for members of, at least in modern times, to cross party lines to vote for. One of them is Jared Golden. There's really no way, you know, to discipline him. And I've been reading about David Dana has a great piece on this and disciplining. The question is whether Jeffries is going to discipline Gleason Kemp-Perez. Who went across. She has a prime seat on the Appropriations Committee. But there's also some progressives who are worried that if the precedent's set about punishing people who don't vote with Democrats, so they're trying to tailor something that is narrow enough circumstance. But what's your sense, what are you hearing in regards to, what that says about Hakeem Jeffries' shop, that they didn't know this was coming, that he was obviously blindsided by it.
Yep.
What are you hearing in that regard?
Yeah, I heard some, you know, I think it was the lack of knowledge was a bad Jeffries look, I think. Even that's part of why you've seen an uncharacteristically aggressive public pushback since then. It's not something Democrats usually do. To me,
did he take another picture of himself with a bat?
What'd you say?
Did he take another picture of himself with a bat? That really is intimidating.
But to me, I think this speaks to Democrats who are much more tuned in to to holding the own call. Like the desire for fight is such where I think that these type of moments where Democrats, particularly Democrats who like building some Republican alignment credentials every now and then, would do some of this stuff without reproach are over. Because the base is much more tuned in, and I think there is much more, I think just like kind of social cost and penalty to pay for that. But, you know, I also am skeptical of their desire to really fully discipline folks on this front, because they do want some form of independence maintained, and I do think progressives have an interest even in making sure some form of that independence is maintained. What to me feels like the clearest kind of violation is the lack of knowledge, and what feels to me like a clear rebuke, like, you know, a movement around leadership. So, you know, I guess I think Jeffries is in a larger question of his, you know, I think that meeting with Kushner,
yes,
I think I just mean the meeting with Kushner is a little more, maybe more important than this.
Yes.
Like, I think some of that DC, like, you know, glad handshaking, like, you know, normal politics as usual, is something that has not shown its own political benefit. You know, what are they getting from these meetings with Kushner? You know, what are they getting from, like, the kind of deference, the Washington deference they continue to offer Republicans? I think the base is increasingly questioning that.
Do you think that this is, if we're doing death by a thousand cuts for Jeffries here, like, it looks like Schumer is kind of dead man walking, I've been saying for a while, but is Kushner, I mean, seriously though, this guy's not officially a part, who believes a said that he was meeting with the unofficial Middle East envoy, Jared Kushner, who had Netanyahu sleep in his childhood bed about affordability? I mean, give me a break.
I remember seeing in that Mamdani profile last year, like, you could feel Jeffries' struggle intensifying. Like, you know, whether that's his own district, whether that's a base that he's increasingly misaligned with, or whether that is, like, whether he can hold on to establishment support in the same way, right? You can get squeezed from both sides. I think Jeffrey's got a tight rope to walk and the next year or so. But I don't think I would count him out so fast. I think there's a version of someone, and I think particularly in the House, that's a tough job. And you gotta be willing, you keep that job through not just your public posture, but a private posture too. And that's a separate skill. I think Hakeem Jeffries can be quite adept at the second skill and maybe not as adept as the first one. But I'm just saying, like, it's a tough job to hold overall. Just ask the Republicans.
Yeah, my sense is if Jeffries loses that position, it's because he loses a primary.
The primary is much more plausible than him becoming Washington incompatible, or they're ousting him in D.C.
Yeah, that's my sense too. Because they, you know, who wants that job right now?
Nobody wants that job.
Nobody wants that job right now, as far as I can tell. Estead Herndon, thank you so much. Really appreciate you coming on and talking about this, and really appreciate the work you do in general. You're watching your show, reading your work. I really appreciate it.
No, I love doing it, and enjoy you all's work too. So see you soon.
See you soon. All right, folks. I think that does it for the free show on this Friday. Just a reminder, you can be help us keep on keeping on, as it were, by becoming a member at jointhemajorityreport.com.
McConaughey over here.
Yeah. What is that?
It's like a McConaughey phrase.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I was saying it way before he was. Trust me. Trust me on this. He was in diapers when I was saying that. But you can help us survive and thrive by becoming a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you not only get the free show free of commercials, but you also get the fun half. Also, again, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. Matt, what's happening in the Matt Lekian Media universe?
Yeah, if you're one of the many people who, I mean, like, Majority Report audience, like, you want to see more Matt on the screen. Today's Jacobin show is for you. Me and David are talking about a number of things, including James Carville, his deathbed confessions that the media keep deciding to air as Democratic Party strategy. And that's coming up right after the show today.
I'm not dead yet.
Exactly.
Hey, man, I'm still here.
Literally, like, I don't know.
One more time. I got one more thing to say on my deathbed.
Completely looking at the underneath of the bottom of his chin because he's laying on a pillow. But yeah, he thinks Democratic Socialists run under their own party. and we tell them to cry about it. So, coming up at 3 o'clock Eastern time on the Jacob and Meg YouTube channel.
Do you think there's a chance that they're going to be interviewing him when he's, like, in a bed like this, and he's just, like, hits a button? And,
yeah.
Yes.
You didn't have these progressives in here.
You can hear him, like, elevate his legs.
He's the not dead guy in Monty Python and the Holy Grail.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Just a flesh wound.
Yeah, I'm not dead yet.
Yeah.
Just a primary
loss. Bring out
your
dead.
I just got an IM about this, and I will explain this to people right now about Andy Cohen, just so that I don't leave people hanging in the free half of the show.
Mm-hmm.
I did a 6-part mini series sequel to the movie I did, Who's the Caboose, for a channel called Trio in 2004 that in January of 2005 was essentially folded into Bravo.
Mm.
And the sequel was, Who's the Caboose was a mock documentary, or really a faux verite, if we want to get specific.
Oh, God,
and the series was a sort of in the vein of the Seven Ups and Helter Skelter, came back 7 years later, and it ended in the executive's office at this Trio, and Andy Cohen was an executive there. I think he had one word in the show.
Hmm.
And then Trio gets bought by Bravo. He and Lauren Zelaznik, who is the head of Trio, go over to Bravo. They do the Housewives things, and he becomes an on-air personality, and that's it.
Yes.
I don't know if it was based on that, he used the demo reel from that show or what, but that's what.
Well,
it
he's
was.
Sarah Jessica Parker's best friend, so perhaps you got that's how you got that Sex in the City gig. You ever thought about that?
No, because I had the Sex in the City gig 4 years before that.
Oh, dang it! All right. Well. Oh well.
Yeah.
Well, Andy Cohen, thank you so much for being responsible for so much joy in my life and for introducing me to all of these women that I love so much.
That was
you're
completely
watching.
Unnecessary. See you in the fun half. 3 months from now, 6 months from now, 9 months from now, and I don't think it's going to be the same as it looks like in 6 months from now, and I don't know if it's necessarily going to be better 6 months from now than it is 3 months from now. But I think around 18 months out, we're going to look back and go like, wow.
What? What is that going on?
It's nuts.
Wait a second. Hold on for a second.
The Majority Report.
Emma, welcome to the program.
Hey.
Matt.
Who?
What is up, everyone? Nomi Keen.
You did it. Let's go, Brandon.
Bradley, you want to say hello?
Sorry to disappoint everyone. I'm just a random guy.
It's all the boys today.
Fundamentally false.
No, I'm sorry. Women.
Stop talking for a second. Now let me finish.
Where is this coming from, dude?
But, dude, you want to smoke this 7A?
Yes.
Hi, me? You safe?
Yes.
Is this me?
Is it me?
It is you.
Is this me? Hello, is this me?
I think it is you. Who is you? No sound. Every single freaking day. What's on your mind?
Sports. We can discuss free markets and we can discuss capitalism.
Oh, I'm going to go start life.
Libertarian.
They're so stupid though.
Common sense says of course.
Gobbledygook.
We fucking nailed him.
So what's 79 plus 21?
Challenge met.
I'm positively quivering.
I believe 96, I want to say. 857-210-3501. 1/2. 3/8.
9/11, for instance.
$3,400. $1,900.
$5.43 trillion.
Sold.
It's a zero-sum game.
Actually, you're making me think less of
it. But let me say this.
Poop. You call it satire. Sam goes satire.
On top of it all,
yeah.
My favorite part about you is just like every day, all day, like everything you do.
Without a doubt. Hey, buddy, we see you. All right, folks.
It's just the week being weeded out, obviously.
Yeah, Sundial Guns out. I don't know.
But you should know.
People just don't like to entertain ideas anymore.
I have a question. Who cares?
Our chat is enabled,
wow,
folks.
I love it.
I do love that.
Look, gotta jump. Gotta be quick. I gotta jump.
I'm losing it, bro.
2 o'clock. We're already late, and the guy's being a dick. So screw him. Sent to a gulag?
Outrageous.
Like, what is wrong with you?
Love you. Bye.
Love you. Bye-bye. We are back. Sam Cedar, Emma Vigeland. The fun half of the Majority Report. I don't know if there is a candidate running for the Senate in the country who has gotten more attention from the mainstream media, not necessarily positive, like a questioning than Abdul El-Sayed. I mean, am I right about that?
You are. I mean, but there's obviously an explanation for it, right? Which is that he is a Muslim man, and this country's Islamophobia, and we should probably just say anti-Muslim racism, because it's not a phobia, it's just racism, is so quotidian and ubiquitous and bipartisan, and the fact that he stands for things like Medicare for All and ending arms to Israel, it just makes for this toxic stew where there's this fixation with trying to define him, but I think they're just giving him more and more attention.
And let's be clear also, you know, we don't want Sharia law.
Well, let's not get too hasty here, okay?
Yeah, I'm open.
What's in it for me? Can I get some sort of, like...
I love religious theocracies.
Well, I'll vote for Sharia law. I'll break rank if they give me something like the Lobsterman Bill. I mean, right.
There you go.
If they retire Odell Beckham Jr.'s number, then maybe I will.
I am in favor of no interest. That is one thing I do like about Sharia law.
Oh, that's nice.
He was on with, who was he on with again now?
Stephen A. Smith.
The straight shooter himself.
That's right.
Can we put the screen up? Like, look at Stephen A.'s face here as well. If you just want an indication of. This is where journalism in America is right now.
Can't believe what he's hearing.
Stephen A. Smith, fresh off getting the National Association of Black Journalists thumbs down award. That's not a joke.
I know. I saw they were pissed at him, but that's what it's called?
Yes.
Yeah, he doesn't. He's a total clown. But
friend of Mark Levine.
But the argument that, and Sean Hannity, the argument that Abdul El-Sayed makes here could be applied also to his appearances on this show.
What I'm saying is there are 3 million people who listen to Hassan.
Understood.
And I want to offer them a pathway into an electoral movement where, rather than sit outside of the electoral system, they see a pathway around the things that they agree with that he says, that I agree with, nice, and a pathway that disavows the things that I disagree with. And so it's important.
So you're not thinking,
right,
about him. You're not thinking about him. You're thinking about the 3 million people that support him, and you're trying to get those votes. That's what you're saying?
Exactly. And let me just be clear. Like, I've been watching you for a very long time.
That's absurd. Are you kidding me? No, the reason why you would campaign with Hassan Piker is because of his muscles.
He's like, wait.
And his dog.
He reframed exactly what he said.
Wait.
Is that what you're saying?
Let me see what you're saying. You're trying to get elected in Michigan? You don't just come on shows because you like the host?
The energy here is so overdone. Like, it's like he's doing a parody of himself.
So, Sam, you're saying this is the Majority Report with Sam Cedar? Is that what you're saying?
You said Social Security could be solvent if we just raise the cap? Is that what you're saying?
Go ahead.
About the 3 million people that support him, and you're trying to get those votes. That's what you're saying?
Exactly. And let me just be clear. Like, I've been watching you for a very long time, and I'm glad to be on your show.
Sure.
But I'm not here to talk to you. You know this. Right. I'm here to talk to the people talking to.
Absolutely.
Right? And it's important to me that they hear my ideas. Exactly. And it's important to me that they hear my ideas for my ideas. And there are going to be places where you and I disagree. There are going to be places where you and I fully agree. Mm. And that's okay. Right. And it's important to me not to just say, you know, politics, as they say, is a game of addition. You've got to be able to be talking to a lot of people in a lot of different ways. This is the same reason that last week I went on Jesse Waters. You think Jesse Waters and I
are the most famous album?
Right. But I went on because I wanted to be able to talk to those folks who listen to Jesse Waters and say, look, I need you to hear me in my own words, mm-hmm. not what they're going to say about me on this channel. Like they talk about me like every 15 minutes.
I got to confess to you. I know interviewers haven't said this to you, but that's a damn good answer. I got to give you credit for that. That's a damn good answer, sir. I got to give it to you. I can't.
There you go.
I'm losing it, bro.
Holy smokes. Oh my God. It's been a while since I've watched Stephen A. Is he always like this?
I mean, I think when he was across the table from Skip Bayless and he was the more reasonable one, you know, not saying things like LeBron is overrated all the time, we maybe missed how ridiculous he was at that time. Man.
I think he's still a very viable candidate for president.
Michael Cohen at the top of the ticket, Stephen A. Smith as VP. Okay. Yeah,
there we go. Let's, and then, of course, Stephen A. Smith bringing up the, we missed this. I don't know if, we caught this video of J.D. Vance saying, don't keep my wife's name out of your mouth. Now, you know what's amazing?
Unless you're Nick Fuentes.
I was going to say, you didn't say this to Nick Fuentes when Nick Fuentes was literally calling her all sorts of like horrible names.
Slurs. Yeah.
He's slurs. And he didn't have the guts to say it to Nick Fuentes, but he says it to El Sayed. And here's Stephen Smith bringing that up.
You ain't going to get into the fight with the vice president of the United States, right? He told you to keep his wife's name out of your mouth. You ain't going to get into a fight with the vice president of the United States, are you?
Now, look, my anger with the vice president of the United States is the fact that he is underwriting an administration that is making us poorer and sicker, underwriting public policy he knows are ridiculous. I mean, you wrote about them in Hillbilly Elegy. Remember that? Now we're fighting a stupid war with Iran he doesn't know how to get us out of. We've got a trade war with Canada. People in my state are paying $5,600 a year to underwrite his vanity. And the man knows better. That's the thing. The man knows better. And meanwhile, do you remember who brought wives into the whole thing? Mm. That was Donald Trump. Mm. Well, a couple of days after I was nominated, he tweeted a picture of him and his wife and me and my wife trying to draw attention to the idea that somehow my wife is less American than his wife, except for my wife was born here and his wife wasn't. So I'm just saying that at the end of the day, if you don't want to talk about wives, maybe you should talk to your boss about how he brought spouses into it. And if you want to raise this idea that somehow you're going to go talk to your papa, who, God rest his soul, passed away a long time ago, to tell him about how he would be aghast that a guy with my name and my faith is running for office, is important to ask important questions about who else might not be included in his papa's America. So I just think it's kind of important to pay attention to hypocrisy, which is something J.D. Vance doesn't want to talk about.
Doctor.
Sorry, making him rap.
There we go. I mean, he does very well on these interviews, and his polling numbers, like I had mentioned before with Ested Herndon, they're creeping up despite all of this stuff. And it, you know, knock on wood, it's indicative of how little the Republicans, or for that matter, the corporate Democrats, who would rather have a closer margin in the Senate and lose this race because it is one more piece of evidence that they're out of touch and that candidates can win without having to kowtow to that third way.
Yes. And I just also want to point out that this is a long history of Republican men eating shit when their wives are being bullied by Trump, we should go back to Ted Cruz. I just sent this photo. People forget this. This was from the 2015-2016 primary. Trump tweeted out a photo of a side-by-side of Ted Cruz's wife and Melania as a way to compare their attractiveness. And said other things about how his dad maybe killed JFK, and then just smash cut a few weeks later. This is the infamous image of beta Ted Cruz phone banking for Trump. And it is pretty amazing, too, because J.D. Vance is doing something similar here. Wait, he's looking for the side-by-side. Yeah, here it is. Trump tweeted out, "A picture is worth a thousand words. No need to spill the beans."
I don't even know what that's even a reference to.
There was something about spilling the beans on Melania's wife. I think that was threatened maybe by Cruz or someone else, some other Republican during this primary period.
No need to spill the beans. The images are worth a thousand words. I got 25,000 likes and 10,000 retweets at the time of that screenshot. And yeah, Donald Trump doing the manual retweet there.
Well, this is the reason I bring this up is because you see how easily these Republicans subjugate themselves or bend the knee when they're afraid of their own constituency, when it's within their own circles. Like, Ted Cruz will eat shit about his wife not being as attractive as Melania. J.D. Vance will do the same to not piss off like this top Nazi streamer about his wife who's non-white. But if they're if they're able to go after their political opponents, they'll engage in it. But I will also say that in the media ecosystem with Abdullah Sayed, we're seeing how instead of how they would instinctively respond, which is to bow down to the dear leader, progressives and leftists are not doing that. And they're responding, specifically Abdullah Sayed, to Jesse Waters or to Stephen A. Smith, these guys who are kind of jocks, with force. And they have both of them conceded his points, like, and folded immediately.
Well, remember, like, when Zohran was in the White House and Trump basically jumped in before Zohran could respond to the "so you think he's a fascist" thing?
Yeah.
He did that because he was worried Zohran was going to have a good answer for that, and he wanted to preempt it.
And the point is that, like, this is strength. This is what, like, ideological and political strength looks like. And you don't get these people to respect you if you lack, like, you can, like, they can walk all over you. Ted Cruz is basically a glorified podcaster now, with Israel taking out ads on his podcast. His political ambitions for higher office are done.
Apparently, the spill the beans reference was to Heidi's alleged use of pills.
Oh.
Jesus
Christ,
God.
Okay.
Right, hey, can you phone bank for me on Friday, Tim?
Oh, incidentally. Dude, if you'd like to let you out of the house, would you phone bank for me, please?
Right. Melania's never taken pills. If I were married to Ted Cruz, the amount of narcotics that it would require.
Or Donald Trump.
I would need as many narcotics as possible. I would want to be on the Michael Jackson, Prohibitol, knock me out for 3 days at a time.
Propofol.
Throw some nitrous in there too.
Right. I don't want to even be I want to be basically functionally dead if I have to see you every day.
Going to the IMs, Pope Pax. Can I get a shofar for my 35th? Now that I'm eligible, my exploratory committee is on the path to a notion of a concept of a conversation about a run in 2028.
Damn leader.
Let's play number 10. I thought this was pretty great. Maxwell Frost, representative from Florida, was on Surrounded. And I guess, I haven't watched the whole thing, but I guess he was like going up against 20 boomers. And this is hilarious. I actually may watch this whole thing.
It really does look good after I checked it, looked into it this morning.
I may have to watch this weekend.
Because you know why it's nice is because, like, you know, no disrespect to the younger folks who'd usually do these Surroundeds, but they're clearly, like, you know, trying to make media careers, whereas, like, these just seem like boomers.
Boomers, right.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's reflective of their viewpoints, too, about what's possible and what's not.
Here is Maxwell Frost.
great ideas that people put out there.
Yeah.
And then they have a lot of unintended consequences. Mm-hmm. Right? So exactly. If we get rid of all the student debt,
yeah,
it's also going to put a burden on a bunch of people like Lori, because, or myself, or
how do you think
all
you'd
of
feel
us.
That? How do you think you would feel that burden? How would you feel that burden?
How would I feel or yeah. feel?
How would you feel that burden? You're saying that
me?
If,
how would I?
Yeah, you're saying that tomorrow, if the United States forgave student debt, right? Which isn't, we're not sending a check to people to buy things. We're saying we're forgiving you your outstanding balance. How would you feel that the day after, the year after?
I would feel it in the economy and the fact that there's a whole bunch of more imaginary money that showed up.
That's not what it is.
That's exactly what happened during COVID. A bunch of imaginary money showed up.
But you're confusing it. Inflation went up. But canceling student debt isn't the Federal Reserve printing more money. It is forgiving an outstanding balance. And you're right. You would feel it in the economy because an entire generation of people would have more income to be able to use to buy a home, to start a family, to buy more goods. And it would actually help our economy. But it is not canceling student debt is not printing money. It's not forgiving, or it's not printing money. It is just forgiving.
It's writing off something. So, it's taking a ledger and writing it off.
How would you? And so my question to you is, how would you feel that?
I would feel it because there's like numbers on a ledger.
No, but how would you feel it in your life?
How would I feel it in my
life? How would you feel it?
Well, I will tell you, my wife's debt actually got totally relieved by Joe Biden.
Oh my God!
How did that help you guys?
It did.
What were you able to do with the extra money? Wait. What were you guys able to do?
We weren't paying that.
You weren't paying it?
No, she was on a forever deferment deal, and we were carrying that. It was great to have the relief, but here's the deal.
Well, then you guys had your own debt relief, so how can you sit here and say we shouldn't do it for others?
Because. It's not, I got a benefit and now everybody gets to have it. No. That's
wow.
It's like the COVID checks. When the COVID.
Okay. So
Wait. I don't even know how to.
Why he volunteered to make this argument if he knew that was what happened to him?
So he's a squirrel who found his nut and he doesn't want all the other squirrels to get nuts too.
Can
we just talk about the economics of this? Like,
well, hold on.
Yeah.
Can we watch just a little bit more? I'm just fascinated as to how this guy managed to be like, I've got some rope here and I'm going to tie you up by first wrapping this rope around my entire body. And oh my God, my arms are, I can't move.
Because, and we were carrying that, it was great to have the relief. But here's the deal.
Well, then you guys had your own debt relief, so how can you sit here and say we shouldn't do it for others?
Because it's not, I got a benefit and now everybody gets to have it. No. That's not how it's like the COVID checks. When the COVID checks.
So it's fine for you, but not for
No. It was a situation where in order to survive, we had to take what was given to us in order to survive.
We're gonna pause
because
right here. Thank you so
thank
much.
Thank you.
No.
Can we bring it? Those red flags did not go up quick enough, frankly.
Well, they're struggling a little bit to raise it above their head.
Yes. Sorry. Let's talk the economics of this. All right. And the fact of the matter is that nothing could help the economy more in terms of the GDP and in terms of growing than to give debt relief to people who have been holding off having families, buying houses, buying cars, buying all sorts of things because they are so inundated with debt. The argument that this is inflationary because people are going to have, first of all, people are not going to have more money. They are going to be willing to spend what they have more because they're not going to have the same level of debt. But we are talking about people who are living paycheck to paycheck. They're not going to have that much more money to expend. This is not like giving tax cuts to wealthy people who are just going to jack up the prices of things. We are talking about people buying the everyday goods here. We should also note, as much as this wants to be maligned by people out there, is like giving debt relief to a bunch of overeducated young people, understand that it is we're talking about the biggest cohort of debt holders are African-American women who have gone back in many cases to these private for-profit colleges trying to get a degree because they've hit a glass ceiling, or maybe not even glass, in their workplaces, and they believe that a degree is going to help them make more money. Very often, it doesn't necessarily. We don't really have data on this because those private for-profit universities don't want to share that kind of data. But that's what we're talking about here. And the idea that we provide some type of like benefit to one cohort but not others. In this country, we provide an extraordinary benefit to homeowners that we don't provide to renters. And that is in the form of mortgage deductions or real estate tax deductions or a capital gains benefit if you only make $250,000 on the sale of your home. I mean, we provide all of that. Great piece by Susan Mettler. We interviewed her years ago about it, the submerged state, all the benefits that people get and don't realize they're getting from the government. But in this case, the guy was saying like, we got it, but I just don't want to share it with anybody else.
I also don't ever want to hear from this generation about student loan debt, because the youngest possible boomer was born in 1964, which means they would have gone to college in 1982. And according to the Education Data Institute initiative, the average tuition for a public school was $1,031, which adjusted inflation is $3,000 a year.
Yeah. And to speak about this economically, the main thing that will be inflated by people with student loan debt being that burden removed is that their housing prices, those boomers you're talking about, their housing prices will stay up. But like this, the economic illiteracy here is like, first of all, it wasn't COVID checks, $2,000 COVID checks that caused the inflation during COVID era. It was massive supply shocks, people buying different things.
And then greedflation.
And greedflation, exactly. And like an energy crisis. But also, it will help the economy too. There's a concept called the velocity of money. You can look it up. But this is a decision. Do we want the money, let's say a person owes $80,000 in student loan debt or $40,000. Do we want that money going to those bankers, the financial institution, whoever owns it, whether that's the Department of Education or private bankers? Or do we want those people to say, hey, guess what? That's a payment I don't need to make to those bankers wherever the hell they are. But actually, I can spend it in my community. Maybe hire a craftsperson to like redo my kitchen or something like that. Like, it makes economic sense to do this too. The money will go back into the economy much faster if it's given to the actual people who are indebted than the banks that decided, yeah, we're going to get into the business of lending to kids. You know, and we're going to stand in the way of children getting an education, continuing their education when their brains aren't even fully developed, make them sign on to debt bondage. Yeah. All those, whether it's private institutions or the federal government, they should take a haircut on that.
It's been a while since I've seen the data on this, but when you talk about the velocity of money, it's almost at least double, if not three times, that when you give money to someone, I can't remember if it was who makes less than $70,000 a year versus when you give tax cuts to people who are making over $200,000 a year, because that dollar gets into their pocket. They go down to their local store. They spend it immediately. That storekeeper goes and spends it on other things, and whoever they buy from the bakery to get the bagels in the bodega, the bagel shop owner pays it to their workers or buys something. Whereas you give it to someone who's wealthy, more often than not, that money goes into a brokerage an account or some other type of investment that doesn't get spent. It just accrues more value over time. That's it.
Yeah. Which ones would the banks prefer then, to continue to make interest off of these predatory student loans, or to have that money go back into the economy
To be clear, these are loans from
US government. Yeah. Most of them are, but there are some private student loans, but what?
It's the servicers who lose out on this more than any other private entities. Leftist big pharma plug. I am a black woman in my mid-30s with $318,000 in student loan debt, all for my one doctorate degree. I pay $3,100 a month in minimum payments, and I am still expected to pay $95,000 in interest by the time I pay consistently for 20 years. No house, no kids, and a 2014 Honda Civic. Imagine what I'd give to this economy just by myself if my debt was relieved. My white in-laws, who recently moved into Jimmy Buffett's Daytona Margaritaville, still tell my husband that they don't believe in student loan relief for the same reasons as that Jubilee boomer.
Yeah.
I also appreciate, Brian, you making it clear that I am well outside of the age of boomer.
Yeah, it's not even close.
Yeah. For folks, I've mentioned this article so many times before, but John Schwartz had a piece in The Intercept. The origins of student loan debt. Reagan advisor warned free college would create a dangerous, quote, educated proletariat. This is not, it's not an economic reason why we have this, why that IMR said has $300,000 of student loan debt. It is a political choice that was inflicted on this population, and it should just be undone.
Understand that state tax cuts, federal tax cuts ended up raising the cost of state universities. And that upward pressure on those tuitions allowed for private universities to raise their tuitions. Let's go to, I'll read a couple IMs, and then I guess maybe we can get into... Dave Rubin, he's back. Or Mamdani on the Capital Flight thing, I think is really good. Let's do that.
Yeah.
Here is Zohra Mamdani on the Laura Rosenberg show. Is that what it is? Talking about the myth of capital flight, at least in regards to New York City.
But they've done studies about capital flight internationally as well, and it's just as much of a myth as it is domestically here.
There is a certain amount, particularly in Europe, a non-insignificant threat of capital flight, we should say. We played a clip from Thomas Piketty, I believe it was, I don't know, 3 or 4 weeks ago, when he talked about there are very, very easy ways for governments to deal with the prospect of capital flight. You simply cannot exit with your money without paying an exit tax or an ongoing tax, frankly. But here is Mamdani.
Whenever I talk about raising taxes on the wealthiest, people will respond with what is generally a myth of capital flight. But the flight that's actually happened, 200,000 black New Yorkers have left the city in the last few decades. There are so many people who still tell you they're New Yorkers, but now they live in South Carolina.
Right.
They live Charlotte, in other Atlanta, parts yeah, of yeah, the country yeah. because they couldn't afford to live in this city. And you can feel that in neighborhoods across the city. You can feel that in classrooms across the city. And so for me, it's always ask yourself, how has this city left people behind and how can we actually start to show up? Whenever I talk about...
You know what's amazing is we have no term for affordability flight. We only have it for when capital decides to leave. We have no term for I mean, you could say affordability flight to people and they'd have no idea what you're talking about.
Well, they'd call it gentrification
dynamic.
They'd call it gentrification, which in maybe 10 years ago was, I think, you know, unfairly placed on the people that are looking for as cheap of rent as possible. It's like an evolution in our discourse about the economy and affordability. It's less about, gentrification is a massive problem, but it's not the
symptomatic.
It's symptomatic of policy choices that are pricing people out of their homes, that fewer rental protections. Now I think we're having a more systemic conversation about what makes living unaffordable. It's not the fault necessarily of your neighbor or the person that's taking that apartment. It's the fault of our government that's not preventing that.
Let's do number 15, since we're talking about affordability. Dave Rubin is back from his August vacation on the Côte d'Azur. I don't know if that's where he went, but... here is Dave Rubin from yesterday.
The cost of gas is going to the cool cat, man. Kelly says, I'm terrified that the cost of gas is going to...
Hold on, pause it. We should say he's taking questions from... And I wonder if he doesn't know these in advance or what. I'd be surprised, but let's play it.
Is actually kind of cool. So I like the idea of what they're doing there, even if it's not exactly my thing. But I will let you know when we start reading them, reading those books to the kids. Right last night we did Pete the Cat. But this cat is cool. He is a cool cat, man. Kelly.
Sorry, I didn't need to start that early. I was just curious what he's talking about in a children's book. Anyway, here's their actual clip.
He says, I'm terrified that the cost of gas is going to supersede everything else that is good, that everything else good that is happening in the world. What are your thoughts on that and how Trump could get out in front of the messaging so that people feel better about what is coming and not just focus on today? We're almost at $4 a gallon in Alabama, and I know people are getting tired of it. My groceries don't seem to be affected. I believe he has to finish off the Iranian regime. Yeah, well, look, at the end of the day, people generally vote with their pocketbook. So if they sort of feel good about the economy, they're going to not feel the need to maybe punish who's in power that much. In terms of gas prices, they are a bit high. Everything that I've seen over the last month or so that I just got caught up on the war in Iran is kind of a stalemate. Now Trump's joking that maybe it'll be the Strait of Trump instead of the Strait of Hormuz. There was a video of Scott Bessent yesterday, again, talking about how we've, you know, decimated so much of their military and everything else. But gas prices do seem to be too high. I'm going to guess, my guess would be that Trump will have some tricks in his pocket to get a little liquidity in the economy going and get some prices down before the midterms. Like, because you're right. The average person, you might just be a Trump person and you're like, you know, prices are, I'm just not even going to vote. And again, that gets to the apathy thing that I mentioned earlier. But I would say even if gas prices are high and Trump can't do anything about it, or even if he doesn't do whatever he can do about it, just know what we are up against. And if you think that the Democrats, I know you don't, but if someone out there thinks that if the Democrats taking power, that's going to make gas prices go down, or it's going to make the world safer, or it's going to be better for America, or it's going to wreck all of those things. So again, that's why I'm saying we got to get a little crazy. Like, they're really good at scaring people all the time. Maybe we have to scare people a little bit. It's not generally like the arrow that I'm going to, but maybe we do have to go there. All right, one more for you.
Republicans famously not interested in scaring the electorate.
This is the guy who's been talking about Sharia law coming to the country because of Mamdani. And so what was his answer about gas prices? Like,
Trump will have a trick up his sleeve to
For more liquidity in the economy. How's he going to get more liquidity? They're hoping that Kevin Warsh will drop interest rates. It doesn't look so good right now. Diesel prices at an all-time high. And I guess he's saying, like, oh, once we rename the Strait of Hormuz, the Strait of Trump or whatever it is, then gas prices will come down because of
the
magic.
Symbolic power of it. Yeah.
Yeah, well, they've already tried to manipulate the bond market with these buybacks by the Treasury. So good luck. The markets didn't satiate or listen. And Norway is now considering moving off of U.S. bonds as well. This is going to happen globally. And what's my favorite thing now is that they're publicly posturing as if they're going to sanction China because China says they're not going to abide by new tariffs on Iran since they get 80% of the oil that comes out of Iran. it was already so laughable, the Republicans pretending like they won this war with Iran. It's even more laughable for them to pretend right now like they would actually stand up economically to China, our number two creditor and the growing superpower in the world. Sure.
Didn't Dave also say this war was going to end in like 3 weeks?
Yes.
Yeah, there's a big compilation toward that effect.
Laurie on the IM wants to know, why does his hair look like he colored it with that Sharpie he's holding?
It really
he
does.
Did.
It really.
Oh, my God.
Oh, no. I didn't notice that. Dave.
Dave got a mini facelift.
What did you do on vacation, Dave?
Dave got a mini facelift. I'm not trying to dag. Mini. I've
Seriously?
Seen some of these. Yeah.
How do you know?
Because it his around his ears, it seems like his face has been pulled back a little bit. Does it not? Looks tighter than it typically has.
I can't see stuff like that.
And I'm sorry, dude. Like that.
Yeah, Sam couldn't tell that we upgraded the cameras.
Right. Yeah. Well,
I can't. My glasses are too bad. I can't see anything like that.
Yeah. There you go.
Well, good thing you won't be able to see Jamie Kirchick.
He goes by James now.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, so I have a little respect as well.
Sam Harris is having a resurgence of relevance because there's a lot of opportunity to complain about Muslim people and to attack them in the media these days. He brings on Jamie Kirchick.
James, we just went through this.
Oh, I'm sorry. James Kirchick, who is all grown up now from his youthful days of attacking anybody who was against the Iraq war back in the day. So we have two real political geniuses here. Here is James Kirchick talking about why there is about how bullying all of the progressives are to the centrist pundits.
Liberal intelligentsia.
Oh, no.
But it's just that they want to get there a little faster. They want to break a few more eggs before we get there. And I still think there is this sort of residual sympathy among people on the left in the United States for people on the extreme left. There's even some sense, a sense of admiration for them, right? That we're not as courageous as they are. I wish I could be as courageous as Zohran Mamdani and can't come out and say the things that he's saying. But I'm kind of stuck here in my political reality where I have to do the day-to-day, you know, give and take with the Republicans. There are Democrats who have spoken out very clearly against this. I want to make that absolutely clear. You know, Josh Gottheimer, who's a congressman, Jared Moskowitz, who's a congressman, Tom Suozzi, these are all moderate Democrats, and obviously John Fetterman, who's been probably the most vocal.
Oh, yeah, John Fetterman. Let me be clear with these four men that he has mentioned. They are conservative Democrats. There's no other way to say this. They are, you know, you could say they're corporatists, I guess, although, you know, Fetterman is just literally, I think, now this piece in The Wall Street Journal makes it absolutely clear. I think this guy is completely checked out. I mean, to the point where it's clinical, but the fact that he becomes like, you know, one of 25% of the Democrats that this guy is citing as being sane, is fascinating. But Suozzi, Gottheimer, Moskowitz, I'm sorry. They could not win in any other district, but the ones that they're in right now. No other districts. You cannot say that for Mamdani or AOC or, I mean, I'm sorry, they could not win in any other district except for the extremely wealthy districts they live in and the very conservative district they live in. They're conservative Democrats.
Yeah. But you're not living in his political reality, whatever that means. As it, Zoran Mamdani, who walks the streets of New York and is dealing with governing on a day-to-day basis, is apparently
has solid levels of popularity.
Is living in a fantasy land without constituents, but the man Jimmy in the podcast studio or whatever his first name is, James in the podcast studio, his political reality is the one that we should be listening to.
You're living in a bubble with at least multiple millions of people.
Yeah.
Multiple right. millions of people. Whereas his bubble is four people, one of whom I think is clinically insane. Go ahead.
I'm Swazi. These are all moderate Democrats. And obviously John Fetterman, who's been probably the most vocal of them all. But there is this fear. And I think among the kind of intellectual class, you know, like sort of journalist types, the Ezra Kleins, if you will, it's a fear of not being seen as cool, right? Because the DSA is cool. They're the cool kids at the cool kids table. And there's a lot of pressure if you are a center-left or left or, you know, left liberal commentator. There's a lot of pressure not to make fun of the cool kids because then the cool kids are going to come and steal your lunch money. And that's just been a factor, I think, of American intellectual life for a very long time. And I think people on the left need to understand.
For a very long time. I got news for you. There was not a single person you could find in print 15 years ago, or certainly not 20 years ago, when Jamie Kerchick, James Nay Jamie Kerchick, was attacking those people he's referring to, the people to the left of him who were against the Iraq War. But the idea that the cool kids are taking your money, I think he means like the greasers. And
Jamie, what's uncool about you, man?
Like this.
Exactly.
We're the cool kids.
Fork over the lunch money, twerp.
Come on, Ezra. Yeah, put you in this locker.
Know all the power that all of these leftists have in these intellectual media circles. Like all of those hippy dippies who are getting all of those sinecures at the New York Times. Go ahead.
Stand that, you know, if you're a liberal Democrat, you really do not share anything in common with the DSA, okay? Because they are not democratic. And that is ultimately the most important element of what we should all be able to agree to in the United States, left or right, wherever you are on the political spectrum, that we believe in democratic processes, right, and the rule of law, very basic things, okay, that should not be politicized. The DSA does not believe in those things. And Sam, you only mentioned half their platform. If you look at their foreign policy, that to me is almost even more revealing because they endorse and support and offer solidarity to a wide range of the most despicable communist dictatorships on earth, okay, from North Korea to the Cuban dictatorship. So it's very they have no ground on which to call themselves democratic socialists. They really are sort of in between that, and I would say just outright communists, most of them at this point. The party is controlled. If you look at the actual, you know, Politburo, if you will, right, it's actually composed of most of the people on that are openly declared Marxists. And so I think it's not McCarthyite red baiting to refer to them as a communist or communist-aligned political organization.
Karl Marx was a Democrat and a Republican. Properly using those terms, I'd recommend Bruno Leopold's book and not whatever trash Jamie Kerchick is talking about. But like this smear that Marx is anti-democracy is for idiots.
Also, say Politburo one more time, you fucking dork, and I'm putting your head in the toilet. Politburo? Is when you call me a communist, that's because I'm taking your lunch money, a little twerp.
Well, the other, the sort of like the, you know, since we're in such rarefied spaces, speaking intellectually, of course, the National DSA platform is, I would argue, not necessarily a representative of the membership of the DSA. But let's also be clear. What are we talking about in terms of numbers of the membership in the DSA?
It did hit a record. I mean, it's now officially the largest socialist organization in the country, right? So it's like somewhere in between 100 and 200,000. I don't have the top right off the top of my head.
People than in any one congressional district in the country.
Right.
And so they are pretending as if this progressive, even democratic socialist, even if you're not a card-carrying member, movement is represented by a group with only 100, let's say 200,000 members. And they need to do this because it's the only way they can maintain their delusion. The idea that Ezra Klein is afraid of a 200,000 member organization is absurd. They are up against the now, I mean, the fact of the matter, you cite four guys who are completely out of touch with the Democratic Party as being representative of the Democratic Party is exactly why these guys are so sequestered in Sam Harris's studio.
Also, the notion that the Democratic Socialists of America are undemocratic is like actually a complete lie. It's infinitely more democratic than, say, the Democratic Party that didn't listen to the overwhelming consensus in its voter base, which is, hey, can we change Israel policy and not run this guy who's clearly sundowning in his mid-80s without any primary process? This is the party that, without any public input, decided to force South Carolina to the top of the primary ticket and foreclose the opportunity for there to be actual democratic debate about policy in a primary process. The DSA literally votes, for example, even on things that people don't agree with.
And they're winning elections.
And that vote, And that vote, which, again, don't we care what the voters think? But, like, internally, DSA has infinitely more democracy than either political party. For example, a lot of people wanted there to be a primary challenge against Hakeem Jeffries. New York City DSA debated this internally, and Zoran Mamdani, as a member, spoke and made his case to keep the powder dry. And narrowly, the DSA decided not this cycle. That is actually an example of democracy. Do you think that, like, and those are members having an input as opposed to some sort of hollowed out consultant based party infrastructure that's making these determinations from on high? So they're projecting once again by calling DSA undemocratic. They're afraid that it's way too democratic.
Yeah, and they hate that voters are democratically selecting them.
Yep.
Well, you know, that's maybe unfair, guys, because they have some real concerns. You know, you look at a guy like Mamdani and see him going around and jumping into pools with kids or helping people, you know, shovel or, you know, fixing potholes or perhaps, you know, making it easier to unsubscribe to predatory subscriptions online or increasing child care and making it affordable and free in many instances or getting the buses fast. But you don't see the real dangerous agenda
taking place in the United States.
Well, then let's kind of sharpen this up in talking about some specific characters here. So Mayor Mamdani, right? I've taken a lot of heat from my audience for not recognizing what a charming, secular, and compassionate man he so obviously is, given the percentage of time he's speaking a sentence with a smile. I mean, I view him as somebody who could have just been cooked up in a lab and had his facial muscles tuned to the perfect algorithm. So
brutal roast.
What are you talking about?
Just baffle 90% of any audience he's ever in front of. I mean, I view him as superficial.
As opposed to Sam Harris, whose face is not moving.
Well, that's the thing is, this is a misanthropy. Like, they hate that Democratic voters are choosing DSA candidates, but this is also, oh yeah, everyone's too stupid. They get distracted by a smile. They're not able to see through it like the 10% of us.
But also,
he's a psycho Islamist.
Think about this as, like, their pretense of being intellectuals.
Yeah.
And what they're saying here, the man is charming, but he is deep down, he's insidious. He's the real mask has yet to come off. Like, how long is Mamdani going to wait
second
until
term.
The mask comes off?
Mm-hmm.
It's second all second term.
Very naive questions.
So. And also, if this was spoken about as if this were, say, a Jewish politician, for example, that
like, has this sinister smile that is just hypnotizing people until you realize that beneath it, it's a snake. The devil is beneath it. We would be talking about how freaking anti-Semitic this is. Well, but his hatred of Muslim people, Sam Harris, it is the major through line in his career. It's soft talking. And it's hysterical. I hate Muslims.
He's a hysterical man speaking calmly.
To see him in the on his back foot with a Muslim politician being popular is gratifying in this way, because these traditional gatekeepers don't have the ability to define him. So when he talks about his charm, they can't address the substance, and they're just mad that the messenger is good at messaging what they're against.
Obama. It's exactly the same thing they said about Obama. He is a celebrity. Got a big smile, but he's a secret Muslim and this and that. And in this case, he's an actual Muslim. But here, when he says, can you imagine that Sam Harris is saying, like, he appears like he's secular. Can you imagine if that was a requirement for a Jewish politician?
Yeah.
Like, do not have an expression of your Judaism in political life.
Yep.
And I mean, you know, fundamentalist Jews, not such a liberal crowd, I got to tell you.
Hmm.
I mean, putting aside like issues of Zionism and whatnot, fundamentalist Jews, you don't do so well. Like what you're wearing, Emma, would be verboten.
I know. I couldn't probably shake hands. No, when you say fundamentalist,
elbows, knees, hair,
no.
Yeah.
When you say fundamentalist, that's what gives it away, because it's not about the religion in and of itself, unlike what Sam Harris would like to tell you, which is that Islam is fundamentally, even though the existence of someone like Zoran Mamdani is a threat to his characterization of Muslim people.
Blows up his entire life work.
Like, like he pretends like he's secular. No, he doesn't.
No,
he doesn't. Right. Nor should he have to.
Right. His acceptance of trans people is just a long ruse. His wife not having to cover her hair or anything like that and dressing it's just a long ruse. It's just a long ruse, and we'll figure it out soon.
Man, he so obviously is, given the percentage of time he's speaking a sentence with a smile. I mean, I view him as somebody who could have just been cooked up in a lab and had his facial muscles tuned to the perfect algorithm so as to just baffle 90% of any audience he's ever in front of. I mean, I view him as superficially charming and quite obviously evasive on points that where he knows what, you know, words mean. The fact that he can't clearly condemn the phrase globalize the intifada does not, I mean, I do not think he's like one of these undergraduate dummies who thinks it must be benign in principle. I mean, given his background, given who his parents are,
can we just pause it for a second just to quickly dispel this, because there might be people who are hearing this phrase for the first time. Intifada means uprising. The first intifada was a peaceful uprising by the Palestinians. The second intifada grew violent due to provocations from the Israelis. So it is a neutral word. It means it has an identifying quality. It is a word that can define something. And just because it is in Arabic doesn't make it scary. But I know that if you're listening to the Sam Harris program, you're already tuned to think it is.
Do you like this angle, Sam?
Principle. I mean, given his background, given who his parents are, given his immersion in these issues, I know he knows that globalize the intifada means globalize a terroristic campaign targeting
uprising.
Jews, right?
Yeah.
This is so the fact that he is so hair splitting.
Pause it. You know who doesn't apparently know that? Are all the Jews in New York that voted for Mamdani? Go ahead.
And mincing of his words on that topic, as well as others, to me is a tell. Now, I don't know that he's, I don't know that he really is in his heart of hearts a proper Islamist. I don't know how strong his actual religious commitments are. El Sayed strikes me as having less of a veneer, and he's more obviously kind of a religious bully And again, I don't even know where to put him on the continuum of you know, Islamism, right? But I mean, these guys are at minimum fellow travelers.
I'm sorry.
With people.
The good news is you don't have to do shit, actually. The good news for you is you don't have to do shit because the voters are the ones that are making this determination. And you're the guy swirling your drink at the cocktail party who is speaking to an audience essentially of people staring at themselves in the mirror and going, yeah, exactly. No one gives a fuck what you have to say. Voters are deciding this, not you and your Islamophobic gatekeeping ass.
You do not realize the sleeper cells that we are electing to office right now. That is the problem.
I can deal.
No,
yeah.
You don't understand. He's here to save all of us. Jamie Kirchick. He tried to tell us what his support with the Iraq war and we didn't get it. When Sam Harris started his funnel around the in defense of torture, we didn't get it.
Yeah.
And we've been trying to tell us, and we just don't get it. It's the mother load of bad ideas. Is there any more to this?
I think we kind of got the point.
All right, let's go to number 19, where only these two carry the flame of democracy. Do you understand this?
I guess.
The torture defender and the Iraq war defender?
Yeah, that's the part that bothers me. You guys, right, exactly. These racists that know they're racist, at the very least, like, they're trying to appeal to some sort of semblance of populism about it and gin up other racist sentiment. These guys don't even, they're pissing in the wind, and it's more pathetic somehow.
I mean, they're talking to themselves.
They think more highly of themselves, too. He thinks he's being erudite and interesting. But you're just like a rank, basically, Klans member the way you talk about Muslim people. Basically.
Being an open-minded person means that you have to be sort of open to anyone to the left of you, right? To the right of you, they're fascists, they can be condemned and whatnot. But anyone who claims to be to the left of you, even though Hamas and Hezbollah, despite what Judith Butler says, okay, are not socially progressive movements, they have taken this bizarre role in the left-wing mind that these, you know, Islamist reactionary fascist groups are somehow on the left, right? And so therefore we have to be open to them. They have legitimate grievances. It is not our place, it is not our place to criticize them. If you are a person of color, we have no right to criticize you unless you're right wing, of course. So there's this whole mindset that I think a lot of liberals have, which is why you've seen so few of them really get up and say, you know what, I believe in a muscular liberalism, okay, which says that, yes, I'm open-minded and I'm tolerant, but there are core values on which I will not compromise. And those values
here's
are
a core value,
you know,
I'm
small
not gonna,
L,
here's a
core, liberal democracy.
Core value I'm not compromising on. I am not going to sit here in my Western cozy bubble in Brooklyn and spend my precious time just debating the ideological character of the resistance groups that have been born out of decades and decades of occupation and ethnic cleansing and that are trying to beat back colonial oppression. No matter what was going to happen, there were going to be militant groups that have things that they support that I disagree with, of course. But the first order issue is the occupation, and these groups wouldn't exist if Zionism didn't exist. So why not deal with, and they can't, the number one issue that is creating or the proliferation of a group that necessitates, frankly, militant resistance to the violent genocidal occupation. That's what they want to debate, as opposed to the occupation itself. So, no, we're not dealing with the second, third, fourth, fifth order issue that is irrelevant to the forces that are causing the violence in the region. No, I'm not going to deal with that, no.
Yeah, but, you know, if there was a resistance movement that was representative of the Palestinians that was secular,
yeah,
for instance, like, I don't know, Fatah or the PLO, then they would be okay with it. It's really that they're supporting it, that this is their resistance movement is illiberal.
Mm-hmm.
And that is really the issue. Now, of course, it is Israel itself, and it was Israel's policy to grow Hamas 30, 40 years ago as a a ballast against an a cohesive Palestinian political movement that was already secular. But of course, that escapes them here. Go ahead.
Yeah.
Two of them really get up and say, you know what? I believe in a muscular liberalism, okay? Which says that, yes, I'm open-minded and I'm tolerant, but there are core values on which I will not compromise. And those values are, you know, small L liberal democracy, women's equality, right? These, you know, freedom of expression. These are the things that I'm not, you know, terrorism, intentionally murdering civilians.
You've compromised all those for Israel.
Freedom of expression. We just, they just had a bipartisan bill saying schools can't boycott Israel. Like
exactly.
I mean, you know, these are fools. Any more of it?
Yeah,
compromise on, and I don't care what you say your grievances are or where you come from or how you identify yourself on the ideological spectrum. And we unfortunately do not have enough political figures on the left who are willing to stand up and draw those lines.
How much of this is just sheer confusion on the part of the young, and how much of this is actually calculated misinformation from people who know exactly what they're up to? I mean, I'll give you just one example. What percentage of people on a college campus, like, you know, Columbia or Harvard or Stanford or any place that would protest Israel or be in favor, you know, uniformly love, you know, someone like Mamdani? What percentage of people do you think actually believe that the hijab is a symbol of?
Oh my God! Is it 2004 again?
Should we let's debate whether you know religious Jewish garb is in some way like liberal or illiberal? Yeah. But we have to debate constantly the hijab and Muslim traditional dress.
Yeah, if someone's fixated on like Jewish circumcision or whatever, and they keep emphasizing it, I think they're an anti-Semite.
Oh yeah, right. It's anti-Semitic to like if you're pointing out the kippah or other religious garb, it's ridiculous.
Yeah.
You know that they're serious though, because the podcast. Do you see in the corner what it says? Making sense.
Oh.
You know, if
a guy
none
who's
of,
lost.
If none of this makes sense to you, don't worry. Yeah.
You're
because they've already told
you're
you.
You're being hoodwinked.
Yes. It's they're now, making sense.
This is like this notion that the secret Muslims are actually hoodwinking and hypnotizing people to be, you know, dupes here.
Like they control the media.
It's like a trope. It's a right. Weird trope. Hmm.
So there's the soft talking masturbatory racism where they think that they are intellectuals. If you want to send me to an early grave, play that on a loop for 24 hours and I'll be done.
The most amazing thing about that clip is him saying like parts of his audience were trying to tell him that Mamdani's like secular. I'm like, if you're one of those people, why are you still listening to Sam Harris?
Because
delete that from your subscription.
He does. I've know people that are not like that are kind of casual listeners, and it's because he goes after Trump on occasion. Like that's the hook. But what
is years after he found out that half, like three quarters of the audience he had built in 2016 was actually pro-Trump.
Yes, but now he's anti-Trump, and now, but he's also so pro-Israel, and so he doesn't really have much of an audience that, and so that's part of what this is like aggrievement for lack of relevance and lack of control over the conversation at this point.
Folks, we're going to have, we only have 10 minutes left, but I will take three phone calls during that time. 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920 is the number. 646-257-3920. I'll read some IMs. Cricket, Gnome Revenge, Sam Harris's eyebrow tilts down every time he mentions a Muslim, just like a cartoon villain would when they are doing their evil plan. He was made in a lab. Tony from Louisiana. Hey, hello here in Louisiana. We have crazy races now due to the governor's effery. So our primary is not until November, meaning the New Orleans DSA chapter endorsed candidate. Lauren Jewett may be the last chapter endorsed candidate running in the country, and having qualified for the race twice, she could offer some inside baseball on the election and having a situation in Louisiana. We will look into that. Meanwhile, phone call calling from a 319 area code. Who's this? Where are you calling from?
Hey, Sam. This is Andy from Minnesota.
Andy from Minnesota. What's on your mind?
Hey, I was inspired to call in after you guys talked about the Klobuchar comb salad incident earlier this week. But just an interesting note. So Minnesota's two senators, Tina Smith and Amy Klobuchar. Tina Smith is retiring. That's the seat that Peggy Flanagan is running for. Amy Klobuchar, excuse me, is running for governor. I assume she's going to win, in which case either Tim Walz or Klobuchar herself will appoint her successor. So I guess the point being is that Minnesota is sending two new senators to the new Congress. The second point is that prior to the primary, sorry, I'm outside and I have allergies. Prior to the primary, kind of an idea was that the loser of the primary would get the consolation seat. But with how bad Peggy Flanagan beat Angie Craig, I don't really think that's an option anymore. So Peggy Flanagan might be pulling both seats to the left.
Oh, that's good. Good point. Appreciate the call.
Yep, thanks. Bye.
Thank you.
Calling from a 310. Got to be quick.
Is this me?
Yep.
Awesome. So I have been a longtime caller, listener, sorry, and I'm a little nervous. But I wanted to say two things. One, you guys need to reach out, and I can give you his private phone number. A good friend of mine, Dr. Roy Casagrande, he is one of the most dynamic historian and political. He talks a lot about history and politics on his YouTube channel. He's just amazing and a good friend of mine. And the other thing I wanted to say was, I think it's weird that we don't talk a lot about how to be a Republican, you have to have some kind of mental damage, like Fetterman, for example. Why is this not studied?
Well, I don't know if you can get that essentialist, but I will tell you, and I appreciate the phone call. There has been clinical, clinical studies by a guy named Bob Altemeyer, the late Bob Altemeyer, who was a professor at the University of Manitoba, that 25% of North Americans, so it was broader than just the Republican Party, are authoritarians, are right-wing authoritarians. And if you do the numbers, 25% of that will get you definitely in the neighborhood of all the people who still are supporting Donald Trump and the Republican Party in some areas. So that research is out there. I don't know how helpful it is, because it's not like we're going to fly planes over the population and, I don't know, spray down medication. Although I guess that's what the
chemtrails are for. So keep up.
All right. Send us an email with that name that you suggested, and we will do our best. All right. The final call for the day, 646. Who's this? Where are you calling from?
Hello, is this me?
Yes, it is you.
This is Ryan from Boston.
Ryan from Boston. What's on your mind?
Celebrating Ed Markey's victory this week. Lovely.
Sweet.
I wanted to call in and talk about the ballot proposition in November for jungle primaries, as they have in California and Washington. I was wondering if you guys had strong opinions on it. The Democratic Party and the Republican Party in Massachusetts are actually opposing the proposition. I am of the opinion that ranked choice voting is a far stronger thing. I grew up in New York City, so I've seen the ranked choice voting in the New York City primaries, seen the result of that, obviously, with Mamdani and Lander. I think that was a great example of it. And then also up in Maine with the governor's race, where Tinegree, Jackson, and I can't recall the third one, I believe it was the attorney general, all cross-endorsed similarly against Nirav Shah, who was this more, like, he was pro-school vouchers, he was not a very good candidate in my view. And so I think ranked choice voting is a much stronger model for the type of collaboration compared to something like a jungle primary, where we saw
in California
where like eight Democrats ran in one seat, two Republicans, and then those two Republicans end up the ones on the ticket.
Jungle primary can be a decent idea, but it has to be secondary to ranked choice voting. There's just...
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
Agreed.
The best way to engage in a jungle primary is essentially have an undemocratic, smaller primary in the first place, come up with one, maybe two candidates, and it doesn't actually get people to engage with the type of coalition building that the New York City system has set up, which I think is
pretty
strong. Unfortunately, we had ranked choice voting on the ballot not too many years ago, and it was shot down. But hopefully we can bring it back. And it doesn't seem like the jungle primary is going to pass, most likely. I hope to get a lot of my friends to be somewhat organizing around shooting it down. And hopefully we can get the DSA on board with getting ranked choice voting in the future. I wanted to talk about proportional representation, but maybe I'll call back another time.
Yeah, do that. But you're spot on. I appreciate the call. Jungle primary, I think is, it doesn't interest me. I mean, if you get it after ranked choice voting, maybe, but I don't think it's helpful. And ranked choice voting, however, though, it does make a lot of sense to me. And it's been very helpful, obviously, for the left.
Yep.
That is the end of our call-in portion of the program. Going to read a couple of IMs and then get out of here for the long weekend. Just a little bit of house cleaning. On Monday, we will have our famous Labor Day compilation show, famous around the office for a way of giving us the day off. But also a lot of great clips, FDR, Ario Savio. We got Bernie reading Eugene Debs, couple others. So check it out. Gulf Coast Grit. Jungle primaries are honestly terrible because it forces all candidates to sound like centrists for a bunch of candidates to split the vote. Louisiana had this for ages. Always produce mediocre to terrible candidates. Tom Cotton's beard. If anything, they'll go and tell her to shut up. We'll probably cut off any further money. I'm not sure what that is. President Tiny D. War? What war? Are you hallucinating? Bozo Bone Beans, special military operation flaring up like my herpes.
Bozo Beans.
Militant apathy. Nobody wants his job. Been saying that. All right.
Jeffrey's probably right.
Yeah. Possum from Queens. Stephen A. Soundboard candidate. I think that should be. That's a good answer. We should be taking that.
Yeah.
Kevin from Madison. Greasers didn't use the hang loose signs. Probably double thumbs up or fake pistol with the fingers and click with your tongue. Just FYI. Brick City born. Other religions require hair coverings, including the yarmulke and even the shaving of women. I hate the hijab argument from other religions who practice similar traditions. Of course. Mark Wayne Mullen, Sam Harris, and David Frum should link up for an epic conversation. I could listen to it in my car while I run inside the garage, while it runs inside the garage. All right, two more. Tongue in cheek. I believe I called it from an earlier submission today. My over-under for the show taking calls is 4. I'm going under. All right, beautiful. Well done. And the final IM for the week, Jesper from Copenhagen. Sam Harris, PhD, was about scanning brains to see people's belief. I believe scanning Harris' brain would reveal a drawing of Barry Weiss on a Segway. Matt, Brian, Emma, great job today. Folks, see you. Well, we'll be check out our show on Monday, but we'll be back on Tuesday.
It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm gonna get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the light bulb. But finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in. And my pilot light's shining bright. I get somewhere the choice is made. For the option where you don't get paid, for the road that bends before it finally breaks you. I guess somehow I lost my drive between the 101 and the 5. Do you know how far the detour takes you? Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick. Shifted in and out.